Now, this is tape 3 of the interview with Dr. Wilson of Ketchikan. In reading this, it's in that other book. There were a couple accounts of you wrote up going out into the bush to, in emergency situations. How often did you have to do that? Was that a frequent occurrence?
Well, no. It wasn't frequent down here. I think I operated on two men out in the kitchen table and camp. We frequently did have to go out and get somebody who was hurt and bring them in. If you mean, did this happen once a week? Probably somebody from town would make a trip as often as once a week. I suppose that it probably averaged that much. We had the fishing grounds here, you know, that some of these fellows would get hurt out there on a fishing boat and have to be brought in. And then, of course, there were logging camp accidents. Particularly during the war and afterwards, when the logging camps really were cutting a lot of wood. So I think that somebody from town was away on a trip at least once a week. The doctors all would, help each other out on any of these things. If you got out there and found you're going to send somebody in, well, you'd send in a message, and one or two of your friends would have things ready to help take care of whoever was injured.
I would think it'd be a bit frightening doing surgery away from a hospital.
Well, yeah, you didn't do anything more than you had to.
Yeah.
The two times that I was referring there, when I had to take out the appendix out there in the camp, both in the summer, it had been raining so that the muskeg was knee deep in water.
Mm-hmm.
Each camp was a good 2 miles from the beach, so if they tried to carry the patient to the beach, they'd have had to have him on a stretcher with all the motion that he'd be subjected to for 2 miles getting him down to an airplane. I had taken along with me the surgical supplies from the hospital, and the nurse to give an anesthetic and another one to help me. So it was really, I figured, safer for the patient under those conditions to stay right there and take care of him than to try to move him. You didn't get into anything more than you had to.
Yeah. But sometimes you don't have any choice, I guess.
You don't have a choice. And then what we would do would be to leave a nurse there to change the dressings every day, and I'd come on back and forth. I'd run airplane in and ride out the next day, see the patient and back, until they're safe to leave them. So we did some of that here, but not as much as some places. Did you ever read a book called Horse and Buggy Doctor?
No, I haven't.
The Horse and Buggy Doctor is written by a surgeon in Kansas. Halsted, H-A-L-S-T-E-D, or is Halsted the name of the town? Halsted might be the name of the town. This was about his experiences back in the old 1880s, 90s, early 1900s, going through that period. And you'd enjoy reading that. You can get a paperback. I got it in a paperback. He just told of his experiences all around that corner of Kansas and even patients as he go to see over in Oklahoma. But he got in some awful, he did an awful lot of surgery out there in the kitchens, awful lot, I thought. You ought to get that read it sometime. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Just a little book.
Yeah, I'll check that out. It sounds like it would be good.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those gems. And well, where were we here?
Well, I also wanted to ask about read in here about the polio epidemic.
Now, sure. That was 51, 52, 55. And we did. We had a lot. Is that paper in there that I sent to the University of Washington?
Yes.
Their team of the epidemiologist was up here. Somebody put on a campaign to get throat cultures from anybody who came down and volunteered. And they got about 600 throat cultures there. This team that I'm talking about wasn't in regard to polio. The team that I mentioned right now with the 600 cultures was a diphtheria one that came along several years afterwards. The polio epidemic hit here. In 18 cases. Among them, we had three deaths. Next year, we had a light. We got along very well with only three cases. But in 1952, that was a big year, 88, with two deaths. We had a iron run that would be flown in here through the National Polio Association. If one was needed, well, they'd fly one in, and we used that several occasions to put a patient who was paralyzed in and then get him moved down the cell. This was all under the what they call the MAPS program, being medical MAPS, medical aircraft transportation. I forget what the S was for, but it was a federal program.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the airplanes and the iron lungs, and we used them several times there.
What happened to those people that were in iron lungs? Did they recover? Was there some recovery?
Yeah, some of them did. Uh-huh. They kept them in there until they were able to breathe on their own. They would leave them out in the air for a little while every day without the machine going, and then as they were able to stand a little longer period, why they would do that. No, a lot of them got well. So we had one of the highest death rates in the whole country. During those epidemics. Then there was a team from the one of the epidemiologists anyway from the University of Washington did run through a lot of blood samples to see what they could find from the reports of that, and they decided that there really hadn't been any polio here. All the polio that had been here had been prior to 1900, so we'd gone almost 50 years without any polio until this hit.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
During that time, I think it was about 1955, we had a medical meeting over in Sitka, Modetka, which featured polio, and two of the professors from back at Evanston, Illinois, were up here. These men both had my son James gone back there to intern, and met them, and they were outstanding, you know. And we got them up to that medical meeting. Then after that, why we had all these clinics here, these polio clinics. I think I said something either to you yesterday or it might be in here about Dr. Phil Moore from Sitka.
Oh, yeah.
Phil had, when he got out of the Navy, he was offered a position with the U.S. Public Health Service, which put him in Mount Edgecombe. And there was some connection there with the ANS. I've forgotten how that was. But he had a tremendous buildup. I never saw anybody with that kind of build up before it. Several years previously, the orthopedic hospital in Seattle, the Children's Orthopedic, had a build up of the same kind when they wanted to get a orthopedist from Spokane to move to Seattle. And all these ladies with plenty of time on their hands who had some money or in this auxiliary, you know, gosh, this doctor from Spokane was a brilliant man. Had everything going his way and polio patients being referred to him. Well, in the same way over here with Phil Moore, they started these auxiliaries here. Gosh, there were six, probably half a dozen at least, towns up and down Alaska with Phil Moore auxiliary groups. So he got all the money he needed to look after these chronic polio people. And he was always good. He had a good physical therapy outfit there, some very good help. And he was painstaking, and he was just absolutely all right. And as I told you yesterday, my gosh, between that and this bone and joint tuberculosis, which there seemed to be a great deal of it in the 1950s, he got an experience. Well, one of these pictures I have is of that medical meeting over there in Sitka. I don't know whether you want these pictures. You can take them home and use them if you do. One of them here and one of them over at Mogetchkin. I wrote enough on the back of each one to identify them. If you want to take those and use them, they're fine. When you're done, you can mail them back.
Okay.
I don't really have any snapshots from these meetings, or little snapshots which I have taken. If I get over some, I can mail them up to you, though.
That'd be great. You're great.
If you want to see some of those. Along there in the time I'm speaking of 1950s, on in there, we were still a territory. The territorial medical meetings would be staggered around the country. Milo, have you met Milo?
No, I haven't yet.
I didn't tell you too much about Milo. Oh my gosh, he is a character, that guy. But it was in the, somewhere in that period, I went up here to Juneau to a medical meeting. And they put me on the nominating committee. Well, my old friend Walkowski was up there in Anchorage, and I thought, gee whiz, Wally ought to be president of this association. He never has. I am going to nominate him. So at the Bill Whitehead's cocktail party, it was a big party. I guess those rumors spread pretty fast there. And I hadn't any more got back to my hotel room after this party than somebody from Anchorage called me up and said they wanted to see me. And so they came over. And my gosh, here were metal doctors from Anchorage in the room. And so I laughed, and they said, now, doctor, is that we know that you want to put put Dr. Wolkowski's name up for president. And we love him. He's just a great old guy, which is true. But he doesn't want to be president, and we want Malhoffes. Well, you got over 50% of the vote right here in this room, so. Oh, it's one of those funny things. But Milo is a outspoken person. He's careful in his work. He's impetuous. And he sure steps on some people's toes, you know. And of course, he got along all right. And then he was delegate to the AMA for several years. Seems to me he was delegate for 6 years. If you can anywhere find the delegate's letter that he wrote every year when he came back from the AMA meeting, if you can find the, they were printed, I'm sure, in the Alaska medicine.
Mm-hmm.
If you can find those, there's some reading that you should not pass up, but it just, the diction is excellent, and he is very, very interesting and forceful. And they don't agree with some of his ideas, but well, so along the 1950s, or that was what Milo was doing, and then 1963 was that earthquake?
64
was the earthquake. And this building that he built in Anchorage, the one that he had remodeled, and he really remodeled that thing so that he had offices as well as living quarters there. Well, it got shaken up to where it wasn't safe to use, and you had to tear it down and go rent space from the Providence Hospital until he could do something else.
Did you say something about a typhoid epidemic here? Or what?
Typhoid? I said there was a undergrowth fever epidemic here.
Well, you mentioned about doing throat cultures on 600 people.
Diphtheria,
yeah.
The time I'm talking about, it was the diphtheria, was about 1961, 62, along in there.
Hmm.
And we had some diphtheria. So all people down in Atlanta,
Center for Disease Control, is that it?
Hmm?
CDC?
CDC, Center for Disease Control. That's a great place. Well, they sent up an epidemiologist, and this doctor started getting all the throat cultures he cut there at the health center. And he wasn't getting enough, and he said, well, so I'm just going to go down to the bars and get them down there. And by golly, he did. He'd take his helper and all the test tubes and swabs and go down there and talk to the people in the bars and get throat swabs from them. So they got 600 throat cultures run. I think they had about 6 or 8 positive ones in that who were carriers who went ahead and got their vaccine, and the people who were sick got their vaccine and got well.
Hmm.
I think it was about 62 or so. Yeah, now the CDC always came to our rescue anytime we had problems. We would just call them up and talk to them and say, here, this is what we have, and send up some medicine if we needed it, or information, or what have you. after these polio epidemics, then we had some big polio vaccinating clinics for several years, and we vaccinated several hundred each year, and then we got vaccinating the youngsters in preschool. So what was that part of the story?
Yeah, pretty much wiped out polio.
Yeah.
Do you feel that medical care in Ketchikan is good?
Oh yeah.
And it always has been comparable to a city of the same size in the lower 48?
Oh yeah. In fact, better than lots and lots of places. Where we have remarks from some of these doctors whom we send patients to that say, well, we're glad this guy got in here, hands up here. He might have been in Podunk, Washington, or even city the same size as this, and been a whole lot worse off. No, no, we have excellent, excellent medical care here.
What about, I assume, you know, there's a lot of transients come through Ketchikan, people working on the canneries or doing a bit of logging. Does that introduce any unique character to the medicine, the practice of medicine?
Well, I don't know whether it does that. It means that these people coming through who are working on a fishing boat, for instance, are just here for the short time of the summer. The hospital finally has taken on some emergency room physicians to keep the emergency room to take care of the patients who show up at the emergency room, because there were times that it was just difficult to find some doctor to leave his office and come in here, look after some guy in the emergency room. Now, this year is the first time we've tried that emergency room service. Not that we didn't want to do it before, but it's such a doggone expensive, such a cost item that you have to be very careful when you are going to, well, run into a lot more debt than you should. But it seems to be working out pretty well, and what they've decided to do is to have the emergency room from about March to 1st of November, possibly middle of November, have it go for 3 months and start it again.
Well, I see. So it was set up just primarily to serve the the transient population.
Yeah. And they are, the transient population isn't just fishermen either. There seems to be a lot of people coming in. They don't come in. They don't have a job.
But what did you do for emergencies prior to the...
Well, the doctors in town would just have to take... their name would come up on the...
I see.
Like that, and they'd be next on the list, and they'd have to take care of them. Tuesday, why, Jim would be over there, and Wednesday, somebody else would, and, We went out and built a clinic building out next to the hospital. We bought that long ago, because the hospital was rebuilt was built out there, and this took us too much time to go from downtown out there when somebody showed up, and so we went and just let them build a building out there.
It seems like, I don't know whether it's quite so prevalent now as it was a few years ago, but up in Anchorage, especially in Fairbanks to a certain extent, the people, there were a lot of people going over to the Philippines, mm-hmm. they were sort of turning to quackery type of medicine. Does that happen down here too?
Not very much. If I remember, there was somebody in the Philippines who set up talked to one woman from here I knew who had been on a European trip that we'd been on, and she got over there to Philippines where she said she had a breast tumor that this faith healers or some kind of healers that we're talking about took care of her, and this thing absolutely evaporated without any sign, no mark of any kind. But I never saw her again as a patient, so I don't know. But I don't think there's been much of that kind around here, no. No. Once in a while, but not much.
When I was talking to Dr. Lundquist, he was telling me about some of his unique patients. One of them was Panama Hattie, I remember. And that, have you had those kind of patients too?
Oh, yeah.
Sort of characters, the lasting characters, I guess.
Yeah.
Do you remember any specifically? That?
What kind of character? Well, we'll see. Let me take you back to something else here. Do you want anybody that wasn't a doctor, a medicine man who was up here?
Sure. I mean, I'm interested in, you know, medicine in general.
Back at the time of the first license laws, anybody in Alaska who claimed to have any medical knowledge or had been traveling around as a medicine man got a sheet of paper registering him.
What?
It was called a grandfather clause. No, it didn't register him as a MD, but it gave him the right to practice.
What date was that? I mean, when was this?
I can't tell you.
Back in the 30s or before
before that.
Okay.
No. Well, considerably before that. I know it went on after that. But so, down here, there was this guy named Dickinson, George Dickinson, who was had been a medicine man from around Montana, I think, and had been up north in Alaska, and he had this license. Now, George's wife was from the University of, was from Northwestern. She was an MD, and apparently she kept him out of trouble, which was great, because George had one claim to fame, and that was his various skin lotions. I'm telling you, that guy would have, a lot of fishermen here would get rashes
mm-hmm.
from the handling the fish, you know, and he had his lotions for them, and they swore by him, and likely a lot of them got well too. I used to see patients come up to my office and leave me and go over and get his hand lotion to use, you know. So, George is very serious, he was very talkative. He had just all kinds of stories to tell me about taking care of one tribe of Indians. The Chief Johnson, Chief Johnson ones who had a camp down here about 8 miles south of town. And he said he used to row out there sometimes in the summertime. He would row out there every day to see the old chief. It seemed that the chief had had a lot of burns at one time. George used to go out there to see him and take care of him and come back. Then, somewhere along about the 1920s, George got interested how maybe he just got hired to go to a bay on Prince Wales Island. There was a very narrow spot over there between this side of the island and the other side of the island, I think about a quarter of a mile crossing. And the place was called Saucer, S-U-L-Z-E-R. It seemed like somebody from New York had some money and come out and found a little gold there. So they hired George to come over and do the medical work. Or I don't know how many people were employed there, probably just a few, but he would go over there at times. Now this was long about 1920s, and George said that he used to row from here over there, which was 36 hours in rowboat, and in good weather in the summer. And he would row over there at times. So if you believe everything he said, well, he was in all kinds of scrapes, and he was always pulling somebody off the rocks. I went out with him one time in his boat, which was a low boat. You had to bend over, you couldn't stand up on it. You had to bend over. We were out for 3 days, came back. I brought my sleeping bag and my clothes up home. My wife took one look. She said, if you go out on that boat again, you can wash everything yourself. George was quite a character. He lived down there where the tunnel is.
Mm-hmm.
His house was there. He never carried anything out of the house. He had piles of newspapers this high all around the floor. The quarters for patients were upstairs. This is where he lived down here. Well, my boys used to carry papers and do it. And one day Smelly came up about smells, and I said to the kids, you know, I remember back there where I used to live, and when I was delivering groceries, there was one house that always had a cabbage smell. I said, you don't have to say anything more. We carry newspapers to Dr. Dickinson's. Oh, gosh. Oh, George. George's wife was quite a character. She had developed tuberculosis ankle. And she used to go around in a wheelchair, collect rents. They owned Oh, and a lot of these little shacks were the rent was very low, and of course nothing was ever done to clean the place up. So they owned a lot of those, and she'd go around to collect them. And she was hard. You had to drive a bargain with her, I'll put it that way. She wasn't mean, she just was very thrifty. George was quite liberal. He had this boat and he didn't want to keep it tied up all the time. He wanted to have some fun with it, so he would go out, take some of his friends out for a trip and buy a case of beer to take along and have a good time, and Beatrice would get quite upset with him. One time he took along three nurses from the hospital. This was in the summer. Apparently when they got around the island and came starting up this way, the wind started to blow fumes back, and these people were all in the back of the boat where they started getting some carbon monoxide.
Mm.
And they all got started getting sleepy, and by the time he got the boat into a little dock out there, here these girls were pretty groggy. So somebody got the ambulance out, got them on into the hospital. And what we used to do was to, number one, just give them fresh air, and they generally would come out of it. But if we had any methylene blue around, that was an antidote. You'd shoot them some methylene blue, which we proceeded to do, and they did well. Well, George was groggy himself. He stayed in the hospital. The next day his wife called me. She said, "Dr. Wilson, you got George to the hospital. He sent down the bank and got $50 for some ice cream for those nurses. Now I want that stopped."
You say, but she was an MD.
Yeah, she was an MD.
I wonder why she didn't practice.
Oh, of course, by the time I knew her, her health was so bad she couldn't. She just used to ride around with her leg tied up, and it seemed that the thing she had tied up around with it was a baked potato, which he would smear over this thing and keep tied up. I had a classmate in medical school named Callahan, who probably knew more doctors than anybody in the country. He certainly knew more doctors than anybody I ever ran across. Well, George Callahan was practicing at Waukegan, which is the town that George Dickinson had come from.
Oh, I see.
And George Dickinson met him back there one time and said, "Oh, doctor, come up to Alaska and see me." So here George Callahan got married 2-3 years later, came up here with his wife. I was going down the street downtown, ran right into him, you know. So we had to get together that week and had some good visits. Well, he told me then, he said, "Now, Art, Dr. Dickinson's wife has got this tuberculosis in the ankle. she came back to Waukegan, where there's when the famous Olympiast in Chicago, top-notch man, he said, "You'll have to have your ankle taken off." So she said, "No." She went from there down to Memphis. Here was another orthopedist, equally famous. So she wouldn't have him take her ankle off. Then she went to Pasadena. Here was another one who was equally famous, told her to have her ankle off. She wouldn't do it. She was coming back home where they, which she proceeded to do and for another 7 or 8 years before she died. But she was a character. And there were all kinds of stories that Dickinson would tell. I remember one time when I was out in his boat and he was telling me about some terrible storm that he had been in. Of course, this boat he had was about 25 feet long. He'd been in this terrible storm, and he said, "Here was this poor man out here in a rowboat being tossed around." And he said, "Doctor, it was blowing a living gale. And I reached overboard and grabbed him by the shirt collar and pulled him aboard." Oh, he sure could tell stories. I told you about Dickinson here.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Dr. Myers, I got thinking last night, who was here in the, at the time of the First World War. He was a iron nose and throat physician. He and his brother, they were here maybe for 8 or 10 years. It led right to Kansas City. They had come from there and they went back there. What relatives they had here have long since moved. Up in Juneau, do you know Joe Lude?
I've talked to him, and I haven't interviewed him yet, but want to.
Joe Lude came to Alaska about a year ahead of me. When I came through and went to the douche, he was working for Dr. Ellis here. Sometime between then and the time I got back here, he'd moved up to Petersburg. He was a Norwegian, and Petersburg had a big Norwegian settlement, and he was there for 10 years probably. Was he that long? I don't know. He was there for quite a while. Then he moved from Petersburg up to Juneau, and in Juneau he went in with Dr. Dawes,
mm-hmm.
D-A-W-E-S. Dawes, the final gentleman, he'd come from, I think, University of Illinois. He was the public health service doctor there in general. He had a lot of ability. Good surgeon, a lot of ability, he was a very quiet individual in his life, but he was very well thought of. So Joe Rude went in with him for, I think, the rest of the time that Dawes was alive, and I'm not sure just when he died. There were two other doctors there in Juneau. One was Ben Devine, D-E-V-I-G-H-N-E,
mm-hmm.
who'd come from New York. I think he'd been a ship's doctor back in the early 1900s, and then arrived in Juneau. Now, Devine got some in with the Oscar-Juneau mine and did all their care on their work for him. He delivered a lot of babies. Gosh, he must have had 500 pictures of babies on his walls that he delivered. He was a great storyteller. Fancy used to run rather wild, you know. He didn't have very much. He didn't have any surgical ability, I'll put it that way. He must have been all right delivering babies because he had not very great money. But he wanted to get a soft berth for himself. And about that time, there was this writer from Santa Barbara named Stuart Edward White, who was writing some Alaska stories. So somewhere Devine met him, and they started talking things over, and World War II started, and doctors were being called into the service, and here was Santa Barbara down there, a nice spot with a lot of doctors being called out, and so Devine just went on down to Santa Barbara, and he would cook up some stories for Stuart Edward White to write about, and Stuart Edward would introduce him to some places, and he was set for from then on. He was quite a character. The one who was probably the biggest character was this guy, Council. Council came from the University of Virginia somewhere around 1910, 12. He was a really big, very big guy, as strong as he could be. He was an outdoorsman. He not only could shoot a rifle and a shotgun, he could shoot a bow and arrow. And he used to go into the bushes up there every once in a while, bear hunting, and shoot a bear with it. Do you want to turn?
I don't think I'll move back just a little bit.
Yeah, move it back. Go bear hunting. There were all sorts of legends that had grown up about Dr. Council. Gosh, I was hearing these all the time. He, two or three patients up there who worked at the mines had been patients of his, and they just thought he was great, and of course he was. But he would tell about how he'd taken out a pair of tonsils with a jackknife up there in somebody's house, and actually what happened was somebody had a great big abscess, a big peritonsil abscess, and he cleaned up the knife and stuck it in to put the pus out. But that's the way the story would go. But he would, he was a hunter, and then the payoff was when somebody who knew him quite well and started getting enthusiastic. They'd say, at the end of the day, Council would come across the Cordova Flats, loaded, that he would be carrying This is when you could shoot swans. He would have on his back 6 swans, 12 geese, 2 or 3 dozen ducks, 4 or 5 boxes of ammunition, a shotgun, and be jauntily walking along.
Who was writing this?
Oh, this is just one of his friends who would be describing it.
Oh, I see.
No, I didn't see that written anywhere, but I sure heard it enough times.
Sounds like Paul Bunyan almost.
Yeah. Well, he was in Cordova. He had just left Cordova for Juneau when I got to Paducah. But he'd been there for a number of years, and he was there when they were building that railroad in 1910-12. They said at Cordova that he used to take his small boat by himself and go over to Latouche to help the doctor over at Latouche once when you get a call. They used to do that. He was a sportsman, and he sure liked to tell stories. I remember hearing about a woman, a story he told at one of the sporting goods stores there in Seattle. I think it was Ben Paris. Ben Paris has a really famous fishing and outdoor store there. Council and his wife had gotten a station wagon and drove across the country, and coming back through Arizona, he said he wanted to go bass fishing, and he knew that he had his bass plugs there in the back of the car. So he told his wife to get the plugs, bring them along, and he'd go ahead and get the fishing rod ready. And he went ahead to get the rod ready. And finally she arrived without the plugs. And he said, "Well, gee, what's the matter?" And she said, "Well, I couldn't find them." And he said, "Well, I'll have to go on back then and get them if you can find them." So the two of them went off back to get the bass plugs, and they got the plugs out of the car, and they turned around, and just then he stopped, and some guy who was sitting there said, "Well, what next?" "Why," he said, "I couldn't find the lake." All a mirage. He was a storyteller.
Well, I think I'll turn this off right now.
Yeah.